Hachette Audio presents The Black Book, written by James Patterson and David Ellis, read by Eduardo Ballerini. The Present. 1. Patty Harney stops her unmarked sedan 2 blocks shy of her destination. The narrow streets packed with patrol cars. The light bars on top of the units shooting a chaos of color into the night. Must be 20 squad cars at least. Patty ditches her car, puts the lanyard around her neck, her star dangling over her t-shirt. The air outside is unseasonably cold for early April. Still, Patty feels nothing but heat. She runs a block before reaching the yellow tape of the outside perimeter, the first officer stepping forward to stop her, then seeing her star and letting her pass. She doesn't know that perimeter cop, and he doesn't know her. All the better. Getting closer now. The sweat stinging her eyes. The t-shirt wet against her chest despite the cold. Her nerves jangling. She knows the condo building even without following the trail of police officers to the place where they're gathered under the awning outside. One of those cops, a detective like Patty, recognizes her, and his face immediately softens. Oh, Jesus, Patty. She rushes past him into the lobby of the building. It's more like a funeral than a crime scene. Officers and plainclothes detectives with their eyes dropped, anguished, their faces tear-streaked, some consoling each other. No time for that. She works her way toward the elevator, casting her eyes into the corners of the lobby for security cameras. Old habit, instinct, like breathing. Then sees a group of techies, members of the Forensic Services Division, working the elevator, dusting it for prints, and she spins in her gym shoes and pushes through the door to the stairs. She knows it's on the 6th floor. She knows which apartment. She takes the stairs 2 at a time, her chest burning, her legs giving out, a riot breaking out in her stomach. Woozy and panicked, she stops on the 3rd floor landing, alone among the chaos, and squats down for a moment, grabbing her hair, collecting herself, her body trembling, her tears falling in fat drops onto the concrete. You have to do this, she tells herself. She motors up the remaining stairs, her legs rubbery, her chest burning, before she pushes through the door to the 6th floor. Up here it's all business. Photographs being taken, evidence technicians doing their thing, blue suits interviewing neighbors, and Ramsey from the ME's office. She takes a step, then another, but it's as if she isn't moving forward at all, gaining no ground. Like she's in some circus house of horrors. Can't go in there. Patty. Detective Harney. Patty. A hand taking hold of her arm. As if in slow motion, her eyes move across the face of the whiz. The bushy mustache, the round face, the smell of cigar. Patty, Mary, Mother of God. I'm so sorry. She can't bring herself to finish the sentence. They all are, he says. I'm sorry as hell to be the one to say it. She shakes her head, tries to wrangle her arm free. You can't go in there, Patty, not yet. The whiz angles himself in front of her, blocking her from the door. She finds the words somehow. I know how to handle a crime scene. A crime scene. Like this is just another act of violence she would encounter in the course of her job. Not this one, detective. Not yet. Give us a chance to- Patty, come on! She bats away his hands, drives him backwards. He struggles for a moment before he braces her shoulders. Patty, please, he says. Nobody should see their brother like this. She looks into his eyes, not really seeing him, trying to process everything, thinking that he's right. That she doesn't want to see him, because if she doesn't see him, he won't be dead. He won't really be gone. The ding of the elevator. But the elevator's been taken out of service. The boys with FSD were dusting it. Who's using the elevator? Someone must have pulled rank. Oh. Chief of D's is here, someone says. She looks over Wisniewski's shoulder. The tall, angular figure. Those long strides, the beak nose, which she did not inherit. Dad, she says, the word garbled in her throat, feeling every ounce of control vanishing. Her father, Chief of Detectives Daniel Harney, a sport coat thrown over a rumpled shirt, his thinning hair uncombed, his eyes already shadowed.
"Baby,"
he says, his arms opening.
"Oh, my little angel."
"Is it true, Dad?" She speaks into his chest as he holds her tight, as if he would know. As if she's a toddler again, looking to her father for all the answers in the universe.
"I want to see him," says her father.
Not to her, but to Wisniewski. He locks arms with Patty, as if escorting her down the aisle, and turns toward the door.
"I understand, sir," says the Wiz. "But it's not. Brace yourself, sir."
Her father looks down on her, his face bunched up, a dam holding back a storm. She nods back to him. His voice breaks as he says,
"Lead the way, Lieutenant."
2. She clicks off something in her mind and flicks on a different switch. She will be clinical. She will be a detective, not a sister. She will view a crime scene, not her dead twin brother. Clutching, clinging with all her might to her father's arm, stepping onto the tiled entryway of the condo. She knows the place. It opens into a great room, a small kitchen to the left, bedroom and bathroom in the back. Pretty standard high-rise condo in Chicago, anyway. But she knows this one in particular. She's been here before. The first time was yesterday. The apartment goes immediately silent, as if someone raised a hand for quiet. Everyone busy at work dusting or photographing or collecting samples or talking. Everyone stops as the chief of D's and his daughter, a detective in her own right, enter the room. Patty does her detective thing. No sign of struggle in the front room, the main room. Furniture in place, the tile shiny and clean. No sign of activity other than what the detectives and technicians are doing. Someone had turned the air conditioner on full blast, the air good and cool, which should moderate lividity. Lividity. My brother's dead body.
"It's in the bedroom," says Wisniewski, leading the way. "Now I can't let you go in there, Chief, you understand that. You're the immediate family of one of the—
"I just want to see. I won't walk in, Lieutenant."
Her father, in that precise, resolute way he has of speaking, though she's probably the only one who recognizes the tremor in his voice. Patty's eyes moving about, seeing nothing. Amy kept a clean apartment. She's seen in her time plenty of attempts to clean up a crime scene, and this shows no signs of recent scrubbing or spraying or incomplete attempts to wipe away smears or vacuum up debris. No violence happened in the great room or the kitchen. Everything that happened happened inside the bedroom. Red crime scene tape, the inner perimeter, blocking access to the bedroom. Her father delicately positions himself ahead of Patty, a protective gesture, allowing him the first look inside the bedroom. He leans over the red tape, takes a deep breath, and turns to his right to look inside. He immediately squeezes his eyes shut and turns away, holding his breath, immobile. He swallows hard. Opens his eyes, now deadened, filled with horror, and turns back and looks again. He murmurs, "What in God's name happened here?" She hears Wisniewski breathe a heavy sigh.
"The position of the body's everything. It looks pretty much like what it looks like, sir."
Patty steels herself and angles past her father, looking into the room. 3 dead bodies. Kate, Detective Catherine Fenton, lying dead on the carpet, her eyes staring vacantly at the ceiling, a single gunshot wound over her right eye. A pretty clean shot, only a trickle of blood running from the wound, the rest of the blood following gravity's pull, probably leaving through the exit wound in the back of her skull, soaking the carpet beneath her, obscured by her auburn hair. Her Glock pistol, lying just outside the reach of her left hand. She focuses on Kate. Not because she's never seen a dead body, she's seen dozens. And not because she liked Kate, she didn't. But because it's preferable to what else there is to see in the room. Something that thus far has only leaked into her peripheral vision. 2 bodies on the bed. Her brother, Billy, and Amy Lentini. Each of them naked. Amy with a GSW to the heart. A single shot. Her body sprawled out.
her head almost falling off the bed's left side, a large blood stain barely visible behind Amy, where she bled out. And then, Billy. She fixes on him, her heart drumming furiously, heat spreading across her body as she looks at her twin brother sitting upright on the bed, blood streaked down the right side of his face, his head lulled to the side, his eyes closed and peaceful. Take away the blood, the wound, and he could just as easily be sleeping. He could do that in a way she never could. She's always had to sleep on her side, a pillow between her legs. Not Billy. He could sleep all night in a chair or sitting up in bed. He could catch some shut-eye in the middle of geometry class without making a single sound, without snoring or jerking or anything that would give him away. He could sleep in secret just as he could live in secret, just as he could do just about anything in secret. He could hide his fears, his emotions, his thoughts, his sorrows behind that implacable, genial expression of his. She was the only one who knew that about him. She was the only one who understood him. You're just sleeping, Billy. Please. It's me, Billy. Come on. Pop open those eyes and say, surprise! Please be sleeping.
Too early to know, of course, Wisniewski says to her father. Sure looks like Detective Fenton walked in on this, on them, and opened fire. Billy shot back. They killed each other. A fucking shootout at the OK Corral right here in the bedroom.
Ah, Jesus. No, Patty thinks to herself. That's not what happened here. Her legs giving out, her head dizzy, an arm pulling her away, her father, and just as much as she dreaded seeing Billy, even more so now she dreads taking her eyes off him. Her father pulls Patty back into the main room. The officers all stop what they're doing and stare at father and daughter as if they were museum exhibits. Behind Patty, medical personnel slip past and head into the bedroom with body bags. Body bags. She can't stomach the thought.
We do this by the book, her father says to the room. That's my son in there, yes. But he was a cop. Before anything else, he was a cop. A damn fine one. Honor him and Detective Fenton by doing this case right. By the book, people. No mistakes. No shortcuts. Be at your best. And get me?
Her father chokes up. Solemn nods all around. Patty's chest is burning, so hot she struggles to breathe.
Get me a solve, her father finishes. Solve this crime.
Suddenly feeling claustrophobic, Patty turns and heads for the door. This isn't real, she decides. This didn't happen.
Oh my God!
Just as she's at the door, she hears the words. Not from her father, not from any of the officers in the main room. From the medical personnel in the bedroom.
We have a pulse! We have a pulse!
The man shouts.
This one's still alive!
The past. 3. Detective Billy Harney rubbed his hands, his breath lingering, frozen, in front of him. A wispy reminder of how cold Chicago can be in the middle of March. 3 hours was long enough inside the SUV. He hated stakeouts, even though this one was his idea, his case. It started with a dead undergrad, a junior at U of C. The area around the campus, Hyde Park, had some rough spots, and everyone chalked up the murder to urban violence. But they didn't know what Billy knew from a download of the data on her cell phone. That this young woman made money in her spare time as an escort. She worked through an internet site that was taken down the day after her death, but her text messages indicated that she had one particular client who had some unusual needs and was willing to pay top dollar for them. In a nutshell, he liked to choke her during sex. He was a trader, married with kids, who made more money in a week than Billy made in 2 years. The kind of guy who could buy an army of top-shelf lawyers to defend him. Billy wanted this asshole to drop his guard, to relax. So he leaked some news that a suspect was in custody for the undergrad's murder, that it looked like another garden variety attack in Hyde Park. And then Billy followed the scumbag trader. Precisely 1 week ago at 9 p.m., the trader entered the brownstone down the street. Billy got him on video but wasn't sure what was happening inside, so he laid low. A little recon work told him that this place was a high-rent brothel. So assuming that this guy had a regular appointment, and Billy was willing to lay down good money that he did, tonight should be the night. Catch him with his pants down and offer a simple trade. No arrest for the prostitution if you answer a few questions about a dead undergrad. Billy could take it from there. Always better to start a Q&A with the subject sweating his ass off and eager to please. He pushed back the sleeve of his overcoat and checked his watch. 8:30. He blew warm air into his hands.
Sosh, how we doing?
He said into his radio to Sosha, the cop in one of the other vehicles, 2 blocks down, staking out the brownstone from the east. The response came through Billy's wireless earbud.
Ready, willing, and able, Sosh said. Just like your sister.
My sister wouldn't touch you with a 6-foot pole, and neither would Stanislavski.
Who the fuck is Stanislavski? A 6-foot pole.
Harney, get back in the car. This from his partner, Catherine Fenton, sitting in the warm car just next to him.
Sosh, how's your rook holding up?
Sosha had a new detective working with him, a nice kid named Reynolds. You know, I bought him lunch today.
Yeah, I fucking know. He said putting extra pinto beans on the burrito was your idea, and I've been stuck in this truck with him for 3 hours.
Billy smirked. Stakeouts weren't all bad.
Hey, Crowley, you still awake?
The third car, Crowley and Benson.
Yeah, just dying from all this excitement. How many cops does it take to rope one lowlife?
Sosh and Crowley had both raised that point. But this was the hoity-toity part of town, the Gold Coast, and he didn't need any mistakes. He wanted old hands like Sosh and Crowley on this.
What, Crowley? You got somewhere better to be? I know your old lady isn't home because she's in the car with Sosh right now. Well, then, Sosh won't be getting no action either.
It was freaking cold out here. 10 minutes out of the car, and he felt a sting in his toes.
Hey, Fenton,
he said to his partner.
What do you call a clairvoyant midget who escapes police custody?
He opened the passenger door and climbed into the warm SUV. Detective Fenton, Kate, shot him a sidelong glance.
A small medium at large, said Billy.
Sosh liked that one. Kate, not so much.
Hey,
Billy stiffened in his seat. 2 o'clock, our first action.
Right,
Kate talked into a radio.
White male traveling northbound on Astor in a brown coat, brown cap.
Katie, Billy thought to himself. Always so intense, so keyed up. He's the only person out here walking. They can probably spot him. But he let it go. Telling Kate to calm down was like throwing a match on a pool of gasoline.
You got him, Crowley?
Oh, yeah. He's smiling nice and pretty for the camera.
I know that guy, said Fenton. Right? That's that guy from that show.
What show?
That show. That movie critic thing. Front Row or something.
Right.
He'd seen it. The Front Row with... couldn't place the name.
We should arrest him for that alone. Yeah, it is. That's him, said Sosh. Brady Wilson.
They sat tight as the film critic waltzed up the steps of the brownstone. Before he pressed the buzzer, a man in a dark suit opened the door and ushered him in.
Fancy, said Crowley. Do we think he's here for business?
Definitely, said Billy. One guy owns all 3 floors. He claims to live there, but I haven't seen any signs of anyone living there since I started sitting on it. 3 floors, probably 8 or 10 bedrooms.
So this could be a real party we got going on.
Maybe we should call in Vice,
said Billy, knowing the reaction he'd receive.
Fuck Vice, said Katie. This is ours.
Jesus Christ, said Sosh. Jesus H. Christ on a popsicle stick.
Talk to me, Sosh.
You're never gonna believe who just walked past me. Crowley, you guys got video on this?
Roger that, we've got...
Holy mother of God.
Will you guys tell me already?
Billy wished he had a high-powered scope. He wasn't expecting this. He fished binoculars from the back seat and trained them on the steps of the brownstone as an elderly man trudged up toward the front door.
Well, 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 said Billy. If it isn't His Excellency, the Most Reverend Archbishop Michael Xavier Phelan. Lord, he is not worthy. Lord, he is not worthy.
Billy couldn't decide if he was excited or disappointed. His partner, Kate, had made up her mind. She was all in. This had just become a heater case.
Everyone take a breath, said Billy. He's probably just going in to hear confession.
A black SUV, not very different from the one Billy was in at the moment, pulled up at the curb outside the brownstone. The windows were tinted, as best as Billy could tell through binoculars and poor light. That was odd, because tinted windows were a no-no in this state, with only limited exceptions. Exceptions such as vehicles that transport government officials. Billy moved his binoculars down to the license plate, then back up. Oh, shit, he said. I better call the whiz.
Why? Kate asked, almost bouncing out of her seat. Billy shook his head.
He said, because the mayor of Chicago just got out of that car.
4. Billy climbed into the sedan a block away from his stakeout point. The car reeked of cigar smoke. Wisniewski carried that odor on him at all times. The whiz turned his round face toward Billy.
How many inside?
We've seen 12 people go in, said Billy. No two of them at the same time. Like it's all synchronized, so nobody sees anyone else. As discreet gets. 7 of them we can't ID. 1 of them is my suspect in the undergrad's murder, the traitor. 1 of them is this film critic who has a TV show, Brady Wilson. Another is a male black whose socialist partner says is some rapper named Chocolate Q.
The fuck does that stand for?
Billy looked at the whiz.
When I arrest him, I'll ask him.
Wisniewski rubbed his eyes.
And you're sure about the Archbishop?
Positive.
And the...
Whiz's lips came together to make an M sound, but he couldn't bring himself to say the word.
It's the mayor. No question. His security detail dropped them off but didn't go inside. The car is parked down the block. How are we doing on numbers?
I have 10 uniforms ready to assist on my call, said the whiz.
10 plus the 6 detectives should be enough.
You don't have to do this, said Wisniewski. You know that.
He meant that Billy didn't have to arrest everybody. He could do what he came there to do. Arrest the suspect in the undergrad's murder and avert his eyes to anything else.
You chicken shit. The whiz was always thinking of tomorrow. Always looking to climb the ladder, always playing office politics. This thing could fall either way, Billy realized. The police superintendent, after all, was appointed by the mayor. The soup might not be too happy about the mayor getting bagged. If the mayor went down, he might too. Billy could get a gold star on his report card for this, or he could see the effective end of his advancement in the department. And the whiz could too. This could be the best thing that ever happened to their careers, or it could be the worst thing. A guy like the whiz, always weighing the political consequences, avoided risks like this. But Billy wasn't wired the same way as the whiz. He kept it simple. It came down to 3 words for him. Do your job. Any consideration beyond that made you lose your edge. It blurred your focus and made you less than the cop you were supposed to be. Do your job. He had probable cause to believe a crime was in progress, and that was all that mattered.
Are you calling me off? Billy asked.
No, no. The whiz drew a line in the air.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Because that would be even worse for the whiz. Telling a detective not to investigate a crime because it involved a high-ranking public official. That could mean dismissal from the force, maybe even criminal charges. The whiz was far too cautious a politician to ever let something like that go on his record.
Everything you do from this moment on will be carefully scrutinized, said the whiz. Reporters, the IA, the IG, defense lawyers, everyone's going to put you under a magnifying glass. You get that, right? I'm just saying it's okay with me if you don't want to push this. If you want to stick with the murder suspect and leave everything else alone. We're not vice cops. We don't make a habit of arresting Johns and hookers.
Billy didn't respond. Just waited him out.
You fuck this up, said the whiz. It could be the last arrest you ever make.
It could tarnish your father and your sister. You could get into all kinds of hot water over this. You don't need it, Billy. You got a bright future.
When it was clear his speech was finished, Billy turned to the Wiz. Can I go do my job now?
The Wiz dismissed him with a scowl and a wave of the hand.
Billy got out of the car into the sting of the cold air and headed for the brownstone.
5. Billy and his partner, Detective Kate Fenton, approached the black SUV parked by the corner, the one carrying the mayor's security detail. Billy approached the driver's side door, his star in hand. The tinted window rolled down. A burly middle-aged man turned toward the detectives as if annoyed.
You're parked in front of a fire hydrant, said Billy.
We're security for the mayor.
That exempts you from traffic laws?
The man thought about that answer for a minute.
You want we should move?
I want you and your team to step out of the car.
Why do we have to get out of the car?
You have to get out of the car, said Billy, because a police officer told you to.
The back driver's side window rolled down.
I'm Lattice, the man in the back said. Former CPD.
Good. You can explain to your friends the importance of obeying a lawful police order.
It took a moment, but all three men emerged from the car. Billy settled on the former cop, Lattice.
How do you contact the mayor? Or how does he contact you?
Lattice didn't like the question, but reluctantly answered.
He hits the pound key twice on his phone, or we do the same. Who has that phone?
Lattice looked at the others.
The three of us and the mayor. Give me your phones, all three of them.
Can't do that. Billy stepped closer to Lattice. We're taking down that brownstone, he said, and we don't need anyone getting advance notice. Hand over the phones, or I'll arrest you for obstruction, failure to obey, and whatever else I can think of between now and when we pull you up to Area 2 with about a dozen reporters waiting.
Lattice found that reasoning persuasive, so he and the others handed over their phones. A young officer in uniform jogged up to the SUV.
Billy said, This officer's going to stay with you in the car.
He's going to be upset if any of you try to use any form of communication. Text, email, phone call, anything at all. Just sit in the car and listen to the radio. You get me?
I get you, said Lattice.
And one more thing, said Billy. Let me borrow your coat.
Billy approached the brownstone and started up the stairs. He hit the buzzer and waited.
Hello?
A voice through the intercom.
Mayor's security detail,
Billy said, making sure the emblem on his coat was front and center for any cameras that might be watching.
I need to talk to him.
The mayor isn't here.
We drove him here, dumbass. I need to speak with him.
The light in the foyer came on. A tall, wide man in a suit approached the door. There was a bulge in his jacket at the hip. He was armed, and he probably didn't appreciate being called a dumbass.
The man opened the door slightly.
Why don't you call him? He said.
See, that's the problem,
Billy said as he leaned in and pushed the door fully open.
He stepped forward and drove a quick jab into the man's exposed throat.
He expelled a wet, choking noise before losing the capacity to make any noise at all.
Green! Green!
Billy called into the radio attached to his collar, while simultaneously seizing the big man, throwing him up against the railing of the stairs and keeping the door propped open with his foot. The other detectives, followed by blue suits, swarmed up the stairs.
Keep your hands on the railing, feet apart,
said Billy, before handing the big guy over to one of the uniforms.
He has a piece on his left hip.
And a sore throat. Billy led the way inside. The lighting was dim, and the air smelled of incense. A staircase led up to the second floor. Next to it was a door to what looked like a closet. The faint sound of music, a thumping bass, came from below.
Crowley, said Billy. Clear the main floor. Soch!
From behind a curtain straight ahead, a man emerged, holding a shotgun upright. Before Billy could yell, Police, don't move! Katie was on him. She braced the shotgun, kneed the guy in the balls, then when the man bowed forward in pain, drove her other knee into his midsection. The man crumpled to the ground with nary a sound, Katie triumphantly holding the shotgun.
Well, there's that.
Another man came through the curtain. This was like clowns in a circus car. And once again, before Billy could say anything, Katie swung the butt of the shotgun into the man's face, knocking him backwards off his feet.
Don't fuck with Katie.
Billy directed officers forward and upstairs. He walked over to the door by the staircase and opened it up. It was, in fact, a closet, but an odd one. There was no horizontal bar for hanging coats, nothing on the floor, no hooks, even. But the thumping bass was more audible. Billy stepped into the closet, placed his hand against the back wall, and pushed. It gave immediately. A false wall. This was the door to the garden level. Billy motioned for some uniforms to follow him. He took the stairs down to the lower level slowly, his gun raised, the music pounding between his ears. Wondering, did they hear the commotion upstairs? But he thought not. It seemed like the place was soundproofed. The music was loud, the female singer's voice sultry, almost a moan over the pounding bass. Billy hit the bottom stair and spun, gun raised. The lighting was dim, a purplish glow. A stripper pole in the center of the room, a lithe, naked woman working it upside down, her legs interlocked around the shiny steel beam. Around her on all sides, women in various stages of undress or erotic costumes. Naughty nurse, Catholic schoolgirl, dominatrix, and men. Some in costumes, all of them wearing masks of some kind to obscure their faces. Caught up in their fantasies, nobody noticed him right away. The bartender at 3 o'clock was the first one, and he was a threat, obscured behind a small bar.
"Police! Don't move!"
Billy shouted, his gun trained on the bartender. The bartender showed his hands as Billy shuffled toward him. And then it was chaos. Billy's team behind him, shouting commands, forcing everyone to the floor. The participants had nowhere to go. Their only exit was cut off by the police, and none of them was in a position to challenge the authority of a half-dozen cops with firearms trained on them. Billy counted 6 men. 12 had entered the brownstone.
"Crowley, how we doing?"
he called into his radio.
"Main level clear. Fenton took care of the only 2 goons."
"Soch, the top floor?"
"All clear. Only one up here is the manager."
12 men had entered the brownstone, not including the 3 oafs they had subdued. They weren't upstairs or on the main floor. So where were they? Then he noticed another door in the corner of the room. 6. Billy pushed the door open. It was thick, as was the wall. More soundproofing, he figured. It would make sense for a sex club, or whatever the hell this was. He walked into a long hallway with 3 doors on each side. 6 more men to find. 6 bedrooms. He signaled Soch, Katie, and some uniforms into the hallway, everyone taking a door. Everyone with guns drawn, the detectives with their stars hanging from their necks. Billy gave a nod, and all at once, 6 members of the Chicago Police Department kicked in 6 different doors.
"Police! Don't move!"
Billy said, entering a dark room illuminated only by the glow of the street lamp outside. He saw movement on a bed. He flicked on the light and yelled his command again. 2 people scrambling to cover themselves, naked, the man on top of the woman, but unarmed. They posed no threat, other than to their own dignity. The woman looked young, very young, possibly underage. The man was 3 times her age.
"On the floor! Both of you, face down on the floor."
They complied. Billy cuffed the man behind his back.
"Miss, how old are you?"
22, she said, her voice shaky. He didn't really want to, but he cuffed her as well.
"You're 22 like I'm the King of Spain. And you, sir, what's your name?"
"What?"
"What is your name, sir?"
"My name is John Barnes." Billy squatted down next to him.
"John Barnes, you say?"
"Yes, yes."
"Okay. My mistake. For a minute there, I thought you were Archbishop Phelan. But this city's highest-ranking member of my church wouldn't be soliciting a prostitute.
especially one who it seems to me is underage, because that's worse than a prostitution beef. That's statutory rape.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Oh, God, help me. Yeah, so good thing you're John Barnes instead.
Billy backed up and peeked out into the hallway. By now it was filled with police. He motioned over a uniform to secure his room. Detective Socha, stepping out of another room, nodded to Billy.
The mayor wants to speak with the man in charge, he said,
a smile spreading across his face. Billy popped his head inside. The mayor, Francis Delaney, was sitting upright against the bed, a sheet wrapped around his waist, his hands cuffed behind him, what remained of the hair atop his head sticking nearly straight up. His ruddy complexion was flushed, maybe from the sex, but more likely from the humiliation that was quickly enveloping him.
You're the detective in charge?
The mayor asked.
I am. Could you close the door?
Billy shrugged.
I could, but I won't. You already had your jollies tonight, and no offense, but you're not my type.
The mayor didn't see the humor in Billy's remark.
This is a sensitive situation.
For one of us it is.
Well, I was wondering if I could get any consideration here.
Consideration? I consider you a moron for putting your job in jeopardy for some cheap thrills. I consider you a selfish asswipe for betraying the people who elected you. Will that do it? The mayor dropped his head.
I'm a good mayor for this city. I am.
You mean when you're not cutting coppers' pensions to balance the budget? The mayor looked up, sensing an opening.
Maybe we should talk about that, he said.
Sure, let's grab coffee sometime.
No, I mean, maybe that's something you and I could work out right now.
Billy squatted down so he was face to face with the mayor.
Are you saying if I let you walk, you'll change your position on our pensions?
The mayor, ever the politician, his chubby, round face gaining fresh color, looked hopefully into Billy's eyes.
Well, what if I did say that? He asked.
If you said that, said Billy, I'd arrest you for attempted bribery, too. Billy left the room and found Soch, a sheen of sweat across his prominent forehead, jacked up over the night's events.
And here I thought this would be a boring stakeout, he said. Want to go meet the manager of this place? She makes Heidi Fleiss look like a Girl Scout.
7. Billy spent the next hour overseeing the cleanup, making sure the scene downstairs was captured on video, getting each arrestee on camera, processing names. Shockingly, several people gave false ones, and beginning the search for records inside the brownstone. Once the arrestees were all inside the paddy wagon and the uniforms had their marching orders, Billy found himself with Soch on the main floor.
The manager, Billy said. Let's go see her.
Coming down the stairs just as they were heading up was Goldie, Lieutenant Mike Goldberger, Billy's favorite person on the force, his rabbi, his confidant, one of the only people he truly trusted.
There you are,
Goldie said, slapping his hand into Billy's.
Big night for you. Just wanted to say congrats. Thought you'd be up there taking the praise.
Up there?
Oh, yeah. The deputy soup's up there.
He is?
Sure. This thing is spreading like wildfire. The Wiz is making it sound like he spearheaded the whole thing. You'd think it was a one-man show starring him.
What a prick, said Soch.
Get up there, said Goldie. Get some spotlight. I tried to throw your name in there, but the Wiz has sharp elbows. Congrats again, my boy.
Gotta love Goldie. Billy and Soch headed upstairs. On the top floor, as Goldie said, the deputy superintendent of police was beaming widely, shaking the Wiz's hand. The other hand clapped on the Wiz's shoulder. The deputy soup was passed over for the top job by the mayor, so he wouldn't be the least bit unhappy at seeing the mayor get pinched. No cop would be after the mayor tried to cut police pensions. The Wiz nodded at Billy and Soch, but didn't say anything, didn't acknowledge them to the deputy soup. Soch mumbled something unflattering under his breath, but Billy didn't really care. Do your job. Keep it simple. They passed by an office, and Billy stopped briefly and looked in. It was immaculate. A beautiful maple desk with several stacks of papers, neatly organized on top. But no computer. Kate was in there with a number of uniforms, searching the place high and low, opening every cabinet, leafing through the pages of books on the shelves, pulling back the carpet, everything.
"How we doing?" Billy called out.
Katie walked up to him. "You know the Wiz is over there taking all the credit for the bust?"
Billy shrugged. "Did you find anything in the office?"
She shook her head. "No records, no computer. The paper shredder's even empty. There's a lot of cash, but that's it." Not terribly surprising. Computer records were almost as bad as emails and text messages. Once created, they could never be truly erased. These guys were pros. They would have records, of course, but only of the pencil and paper variety.
"No little black book?" Billy asked.
Katie shook her head.
"No little black book? There's gotta be one, but it's not here."
Billy nodded toward the next room.
"Let's go meet the manager."
They moved one room over, where Crowley was sitting with a woman who didn't look very happy. She was a nice-looking woman, middle-aged, thin, with bleached blonde hair. She was wearing a sharp blue suit.
"Meet Ramona Delavoux," said Crowley,
who looked like he was up past his bedtime, which he probably was.
"She's the manager of this place. Isn't that right, Ramona?"
"Fuck you," she said, crossing her arms. "I don't have to say shit to you."
"I read her her rights," said Crowley, rolling his eyes. "I have a feeling she already knew him."
Billy approached the woman.
"Where's your computer?" he asked.
"I don't have to answer that."
"I'm going to find it anyway. Better if you tell me."
Billy removed a small pad of paper from his inside pocket, a pen clipped to it.
"I'll even make a note that you were cooperative, and I'll draw a smiley face next to it."
"Fuck you," she said.
"Then how about your book?"
"Which book is that? My Bible?"
"Come on."
Katie kicked a leg on the woman's chair, turning her slightly askew.
"Tell us."
"I don't have a computer. I don't have a book."
"Listen, lady,"
Katie said. "My name's not Lady. My name's Ramona, and I'll call you Cop Slut."
Soch bit his knuckle.
Katie was not the right gal to piss off.
"Never mind," said Ramona. "You probably couldn't even get a cop to fuck you."
Billy winced. Soch squeezed his eyes shut.
"I see your point," said Katie. "On the other hand,"
Katie slapped the woman hard across the face, knocking her from the chair.
"That was my other hand," she said.
Billy inserted himself between Katie and the woman, now on the floor.
"Get some air,"
he said to Katie.
"I'll fucking sue," Ramona cried. "I'll sue your slut ass."
Billy offered his hand to the woman. She gave him a long glare before she took it and got back in the chair.
"Ramona," he said, "we can tear this place apart looking for it. Or you can tell us where it is, and we won't have to. Now, I know you have a boss. You think he's going to be happy with you if you make us break through walls and rip up carpets?"
A little good cop, bad cop. It was only a cliche because it was true. Ramona, still smarting from the slap, a sizable welt on her cheek, shook her head as if exhausted.
"You're not going to find a little black book," she said.
"We'll search your house next. We'll have no choice."
"I want a lawyer," she said.
Et voila. Thus endeth the conversation.
"Keep the uniforms here until they find it," said Billy to Soch. "Let's find the judge and get a warrant for her house. We'll find that little black book sooner or later."
8. A big bust. So a big night out to follow. Billy and Kate went to the Hole in the Wall, a cop bar off Rockwell near the Brown Line stop. A couple of retired coppers bought the Hole 10 years ago, cleaned it up, got word out about giving cops discounts on drinks, and the place thrived from day one. A few years ago, they set up a stage in the corner and put up a microphone and sponsored an open mic night that was so popular it turned into a regular thing. Now the place drew more than cops and the badge bunnies who followed them. Some people came for the comedy. A lot of people, Billy included,
thought this place rivaled the comedy clubs on Wells Street. When Kate and Billy walked in, they were greeted like royalty. The two of them were quickly separated in the rugby scrum, everyone grabbing Billy, slapping him on the back, putting him in a headlock, lifting him off his feet with bear hugs, messing up his hair, shoving shots of bourbon or tequila in front of him, which he accepted, of course, because he wouldn't want to be rude. By the time he and Kate had found a table, he was half drunk. His hair was mussed like a little kid's, and he was pretty sure he'd pulled a muscle or two. "I think they heard about the arrests," he said to Kate, who was similarly disheveled. 2 pints of ale appeared in front of them on the tall table, with a stern direction that their money was no good here tonight. Billy raised the pint and took a long swig, savored it. Yeah, it was a big night. The reporters were all over it. The Archbishop? The mayor of Chicago? Too big for anyone to pass up. Half the cops in the joint right now were passing around smartphones, reading news articles and Facebook and Twitter posts. The mayor hadn't been friendly to the cops' union or to their pensions, so nobody was shedding a tear over his downfall. The Archbishop? That was another story. Some people were upset, especially the devout Catholics on the force, of whom there were many, while others used the opportunity to rain some cynical sarcasm down on the church, some of which bordered on the politically incorrect. Several cops noted that at least this time, a priest was caught with a female, not an altar boy. Kate was enjoying herself. She was an action junkie, much more so than Billy. If you gave that woman a desk job, she'd put a gun to her head within the hour. She enjoyed detective work, but she really enjoyed the busts, the confrontations, the thrill of the moment. She became a cop for the right reasons, the good versus evil thing. But it was more than that for her. It was a contact sport. He looked at her standing by the table they'd secured, her eyes up on the TV screen in the corner, which was running constant coverage of the arrests. She was wearing a thin, low-cut sweater and tight blue jeans. She cut quite a figure. She'd been a volleyball star at SIU, and more than 10 years later, still had her athletic physique. The taekwondo and boxing classes she took probably helped, too. So did the half marathons she ran. Sometimes Billy got tired just thinking about all the stuff Kate did. But not tonight. He wasn't tired. He was buzzing, like Kate, from the arrests. He always told himself that one arrest was like another. Do your job, regardless. But he couldn't deny himself a small thrill after the action tonight. People kept coming up to him, offering their congrats and their jokes about the mayor and the archbishop, which grew cruder as the booze continued to flow. At one point he turned to Kate and saw Wisniewski, the Wiz, with his arms around her and whispering into her ear. Kate had a smile planted on her face, but Billy knew her as well as anyone did. He could see from her stiff body language and forced grin that she would sooner have an enema than deal with the Wiz's flirtation. Oh, the Wiz. The same guy who tried to talk Billy down from executing the arrests in the first place. The politician who was afraid that this bust might upset the status quo, who turned around and took full credit with the deputy superintendent. And here he was, yucking it up with the brass as if he were just one of the guys.
There you are, the man of the hour.
Mike Goldberger, Goldie, in the flesh. Goldie was a pretty low-key guy, who, unlike Billy and his pals, didn't do a lot of drinking and carousing. So it was unusual to see him at the hole.
Don't get too drunk, he said, wagging a finger at Billy. You could be part of a presser tomorrow.
It had occurred to Billy that the press conferences would continue over the next few days, but he was pretty sure Wisniewski would be the one standing behind the police superintendent, not him.
How you feeling about everything? Goldie asked. Tonight. The bus go okay?
Billy nodded. I think so. Pretty by the book. No question I had PC.
Okay.
Goldie didn't seem surprised. Probable cause to search was a low barrier.
Nothing unusual?
The mayor tried to bribe me.
Goldie recoiled. Seriously?
Well, he was on his way to it. He said maybe we could work on that pension problem we have. Maybe if I let him walk out the back door, he'd change his mind on cutting our cost of living adjustments.
You should have said yes.
Goldie said with a straight face. I tried to work in some free Hawks tickets for myself.
Don't even. Goldie drew him close. Don't even joke about that.
I know, I know. I know you know, but... Billy, seriously, this could get ugly. He lowered his chin, looked up at Billy. Some of the city's most powerful people got mud splashed on them tonight. And if you haven't noticed, people with power don't like to let go of it. They'll do whatever they have to do. They'll go after whoever they have to go after, including the cops.
Fuck 'em.
I'm already hearing questions, he said. Questions about the inventory of evidence. Questions like, where's the little black book? How could that have disappeared?
We searched that house top to bottom. There isn't Christ. I know that, Billy. I'm on your side.
That much Billy knew. Goldie had been Billy's guardian angel since he joined the force. Maybe Goldie was overreacting, but he had a nose for this kind of thing in the department.
Watch yourself, Goldie said, whispering into Billy's ear. From here on out, drive the speed limit. Help little old ladies across the street. Rescue drowning puppies from Lake Michigan.
He gave Billy a firm pat on the chest. You're under a magnifying glass, my friend, he said. Don't give anyone a reason to burn you. 9. Patty Harney watched her brother Billy stumble toward the makeshift stage in the corner of the hole in the wall. He was the man of the hour, though he didn't seek out the spotlight. He never did. She couldn't remember one time in their lives when Billy tried to call attention to himself, or bragged, or promoted himself. The attention just seemed to come naturally. People gravitated to her twin brother in a way they never did to her. A couple of cops practically pushed Billy to the microphone. He wasn't at his best tonight. A half dozen shots of bourbon and a handful of beers was probably a low estimate. But everything Billy did seemed effortless. Like this, for example. Grabbing a mic and telling jokes off the top of his head. Patty would be absolutely terrified of doing something like that. But Billy had a what-the-fuck attitude about the whole thing. Did they really come out of the same birth canal 7 minutes apart? I'm Harney, Billy said into the mic as the crowd quieted. You know you got to laugh sometimes, or you'll go fucking nuts in this town. Let's do a little laughing.
You're the man,
said one of the cops, standing just a few feet away from Billy, a patrol officer who worked the west side, a man who looked like he doubled as a bodybuilder. Billy waved the guy up on stage. Whatever the burly officer might have been wearing when he arrived at the bar earlier tonight, he was now down to a tight white undershirt that showed off his ripped muscles and his shiny bald head. Billy put his arm around the guy.
I'd like to thank Mr. Clean for coming tonight, he said.
The crowd roared. Some of the younger cops probably didn't get the reference.
Mister, can I call you Mister? Mister here has been fighting grime in this city for decades.
How does he improvise like that? Patty wondered. She made her way through the crowd and found Detective Catherine Fenton, who was standing by a tall table, laughing and watching her partner up on stage.
Hey, Kate, said Patty.
Kate's expression broke just slightly, betraying her reaction before she recovered and smiled vaguely.
Hi, Patty.
On the surface, Catherine Fenton was a good partner for Billy. They smoothed out each other's edges. Kate was intense and aggressive, while Billy was laid back, less defensive, more self-assured, always searching for the humor in a situation. But Patty and Kate, they'd never hit it off. It was hard for Patty to pin down why. Patty was always polite with Kate. Never spoke a harsh word to her. She couldn't name one thing she'd ever done that would make Kate dislike her. This was what she figured. Somehow, in some way, it had become a competition between them over Billy. Kate wanted to be closest to Billy, but she couldn't because of his twin sister. You'll never know him like I do, Kate. It will never happen.
Congrats on the big night, she said to Kate.
Thanks, Kate said. Her eyes still on the stage.
I go to church at least once a month to seek absolution for my sins, said Billy to the audience. Tonight was the first time a priest confessed to me.
The crowd liked that. Big whoops and exaggerated groans. Everyone liked Billy. He played to the crowd well. He was playing to his phone, too, perched upright on a stool on the stage. Billy recorded his comedy routines on his phone and uploaded them to some Facebook page he shared with a guy named Stuart, whom he'd met at the hospital 3 years ago, back when Billy went through all that horrible stuff. God, 3 years ago? It still felt fresh to her. And look at Billy, still going strong after all that shit. Tragedy that would have broken most people. It would have broken her. But Billy, he just kept motoring forward with that placid expression, like the entire shitstorm that came his way just slid off him. No problems, no worries. It changed him. It must have, in ways even Patty couldn't understand. But you could put a gun to Billy's head and he wouldn't let on. She watched Kate watching Billy and didn't like what she saw. Kate, she had to concede, was drop-dead gorgeous, her reddish-brown hair pulled back, her large green eyes, her hard, athletic body, the kind of beauty that would render her unapproachable to most men. Billy was pretty easy on the eyes, too, tall and well-built, with that killer smile that came so naturally. The thought had occurred to Patty more than once that he and Kate could be a thing, but she'd never actually seen either of them flash any sign of that until tonight. Until right now, when she was looking into Kate's eyes as she listened to Billy on stage. Yes, there it was, in her eyes, while her guard was down, while the alcohol tangled with her emotions, while she thought nobody was watching. But I'm watching, Kate. When Billy was done, he raised his beer in a salute, and everyone applauded. When it died down, Patty put her drink on the table and got close to Kate. She was so near now that Kate couldn't ignore her without being rude, so Kate reluctantly turned toward Patty, raising her eyebrows. "Billy's one of the good guys," Patty said. "He's the best," Kate agreed. "He's still getting over everything, you know." Kate pulled a sip from her bottle of beer and set it down. "I know that." "You do?" "Yes, Patty, I do." "Don't hurt him," said Patty. "Don't hurt my baby brother." Kate drew back. "What is that supposed to mean?" "You know what it means. And you better know I'm serious." Patty wanted to say more, but she'd had a lot to drink herself. And who knew what might come out of her mouth if she didn't disengage. Her insides burning, she set down her drink and headed straight for the exit. 10. Billy took one of the tables at the back of the bar and considered the beer and the shot of whiskey before him. He couldn't remember the last time he drank so much. Someone had put a plate of fries out, too. He couldn't imagine eating them. The grease would probably make him puke. Kate dropped down next to him, and he scooted over. The place was dying down now. It was past 3 in the morning. The place closed at 4. It was last call.
"What a fucking night," he said to her.
"I know, right?" Kate's hand touched his leg underneath the table. Her hand. On his leg.
"Hey!"
Some drunk guy, in this bar that was a redundant phrase, plopped down across from them.
"What was the mayor like?"
"He was a gentleman throughout the process," said Billy.
"He accepted his fate with grace and dignity."
The guy laughed. So did Kate. Her hand slid upward. Billy was drunk and beaten down, but another part of his anatomy sprung to attention.
"That must have been a thrill and a half, catching him like that," said the guy.
Kate turned to Billy, who wasn't sure what kind of facial expression he was sporting at the moment.
"Was it?"
she asked, her hand moving farther up his leg.
"Was it a thrill, detective?"
Billy looked into Kate's eyes. There was no misunderstanding. That hand sliding up his leg was no accident.
"I would call it unexpected," he said.
Her hand moving again, getting close to pay dirt in his lap.
"Unexpected in a good way?" she asked. "Or a bad way?"
And bingo. There it was. Kate's hand finding his main artery, wrapping her hand around it, squeezing it, stroking it.
"It could be bad,"
he said, watching the guy across from him.
The drunk cop was more interested in the French fries.
That's true, said Kate,
nodding as if nothing was going on beneath the table, while she artfully unzipped his pants and slid her hand inside.
It could be very bad,
still stroking the throttle. If she kept going like that, it was going to be blast off.
I need to take a piss, said the drunk guy,
who scooted out of the seat and left them alone.
Bad can be good sometimes, said Billy.
His right hand reached down and found Kate's leg, her blue jeans. At that moment, he wished it had been a skirt. Kate's legs, together under the table, parted, and Billy accepted the invitation, sliding his hand upward.
If it's just one time, said Kate, if it's not complicated.
Billy was having trouble breathing now. He wasn't blind. He knew Kate was a knockout. He'd just never let himself go there. She was his partner. He had just closed his mind to it. But now that barricade was coming down.
Of course the thought had passed through his mind. You couldn't look at Kate every day, spend 8 hours shift after 8 hours shift with her, and not have it cross your mind. Look at her!
Which he did. But now he wasn't picturing Detective Catherine Fenton. He was picturing Kate, naked, her back arching, her hair and her face, her legs wrapped around his back, a primal moan escaping her lips, her body writhing in response.
We don't need complications, do we, partner? She said.
No. No complications.
He could hardly speak, he was so aroused. He was about to launch, right here in front of a handful of drunken cops, none of whom seemed to notice, thank God in heaven. Then they were waving to the rest of the crowd and making their way to the exit.
Just one time is no big deal, he said.
A row of cabs waiting outside. They got into the first one.
Not a big thing, he said.
No?
She put her hand back where it had been when they were sitting in the booth.
It felt pretty big to me.
When the cab sped away from the bar, he was on her, tearing at her clothes, shoving his hand inside her blue jeans, her breath hot in his ear.
Just one time, he told himself. No big thing.
11.
Oh, shit! Holy fuck!
Billy stirred in bed, moaned, rolled over, and opened his eyes to a squint, the pain ricocheting through his skull.
You gotta see this, Harney.
He felt the bed depress, Kate falling onto it. She was wearing running gear, the shirt wet against her chest, her hair pulled back, gym shoes still on.
Figures.
Rain or shine, big night of drinking or not, Kate is up at the crack of dawn doing her miles.
Look at this!
Kate held her phone in front of his face. He could hardly state his own name, much less read something off a small screen. The lasers of sheer agony crisscrossing through his brain made him briefly consider whether someone was reenacting a scene from Star Wars between his ears. Then his eyes focused on it, and he concurred with Kate's initial impression.
Holy fuck.
It was a headline from Chicago PC, an online newspaper blog, the concepts were merging these days, that covered politics, P, and crime, C, in Chicago. The byline was credited to Kim Beans, an investigative reporter whom Billy had met on a few unpleasant occasions. Unpleasant was an understatement. Kim Beans had the tenacity of a pit bull and the charm of a rattlesnake. The headline, Green Bay Packers QB a regular at sex club?
Wow, thought Billy. That didn't take long. Video footage, Kate says. It says they have video footage of him visiting the club.
Not last night, though. He wasn't there last night.
He read through the article. It said that Chicago PC had come into possession of video footage of the starting quarterback from Green Bay walking into that brownstone sometime last summer. The article also promised that there was more video of more celebrities to come.
This isn't good, Kate said. It's all going to be about this little black book that we didn't recover. You know, they're already asking questions about it, don't you? Wisniewski even said something to me last night, the little prick.
Goldie had said the same thing to Billy. But to Billy, the more interesting question was, Who took this video? And why?
This is bad, Kate said.
Look on the bright side, said Billy.
There's a bright side? What's the bright side?
This might give the Bears a shot at the NFC North this year.
Jeez, Billy, you don't see this as a problem?
She directed her finger back and forth between them.
This is going to be your and my fault. We were in charge of the investigation.
I was in charge, Billy corrected. It'll
be my fault. But I was in charge of the inventory, the search.
Trying to stop Kate from worrying about something was as easy as trying to stop a freight train at high speed. Kate did everything fast and hard. There was no second gear for her.
The mayor needs to deflect this, she said. He needs the story to be about something besides him. He wants it to be about us.
So, said Billy, we'll find the little black book today at the manager's house. Last night, after they interviewed the manager of the sex club, Ramona de la Vue, and searched the brownstone without any luck, Billy sent uniforms over to de la Vue's house to seal it off.
We better,
Kate bounced off the bed, or we're dead. 12.
We're dead, said Kate.
We're not dead. You're overreacting. Billy peeled off his rubber gloves. He was standing in the foyer of Ramona de la Vue's house in Lincoln Park. Managing a house of prostitution must pay well, because her three-story brownstone on Belden was gorgeous. Shiny hardwood floors and expensive artwork, updated fixtures and appliances, a cinema-sized TV screen in the basement, complete with rows of the type of chairs you'd find in a movie theater, a master bathroom with a full-size sauna and a shower the size of Billy's living room. This house had everything you could ever want. Everything, that is, except a little black book. It could be anything, Billy had said to the officers and technicians assisting in the search. It could be an actual book, or it could be a computer or tablet, or it could be something on a flash drive or an SD card. It could look like a phone directory or an accounting ledger. It could be in code. It could be scribbled in pencil on the back pages of a novel sitting on a bookshelf. It could be anything. It could be anywhere. But after 8 hours, they had found nothing. Ramona de la Vue had an iPad and a personal computer, and the technicians had downloaded the contents of each onto an external hard drive for later review. But an initial examination by one of the techies showed nothing helpful. Billy chugged another bottle of water. His mouth felt like the Sahara Desert. He tried to think strategically, as Ramona de la Vue would. If I had something valuable like that, something I wanted to keep totally confidential and untraceable but couldn't lose, where would I put it? The problem was that his thoughts and ideas were navigating through a storm of lightning strikes and clashing cymbals and jackhammers trying to blast through the interior of his skull. The worst hangover ever.
Oh, this is great. Look at this.
Kate handed Billy her phone, this time displaying an online article from one of the city's mainstay newspapers, the Chicago Tribune. Billy scrolled through the headlines, all of them about the arrest.
Will Mayor Resign?
Mayoral Wannabes Lining Up.
Archdiocese Statement Vague.
But amid those stories, this gem.
Questions raised about police conduct